Here.
Hello, Barbara's here.
Hey, Barbara. I guess Carol hasn't made it in yet.
I guess.
Barbara, you were at Falling Awake in April, right?
Yes, I was.
Hey, I remember you.
Thank you. How have you been doing?
Pretty good. I love Portland. I live in San Antonio, Texas.
Huh?
Hey, this is Dave. Welcome. We have some early birds. Who is it who lives in San Antonio?
Oh, this is Osborne.
Oh, okay. Well, you're just down the road a piece from me in Houston.
Oh, I didn't realize you were in Houston.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't I sound clearer than the other guys when they talk?
Well,
hello, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, man? How are you?
Doing well. Doing well.
Great.
Busy, but doing well. And how about you?
Excellent. Just excellent.
It's not about me. It's about you.
You know, while we're waiting for everybody to come on, I'm curious. We're at a halfway point in our seminar series. What's your experience from the seminars and the workbook? Are you creatively stimulated, or do you have suggestions? I'm eager to hear your input.
Are you asking me personally?
Yes. Since you spoke first, absolutely, and then everybody else.
Well, for me, I tell you, I am looking forward every Tuesday, 4 o'clock. I'm eating this up, reading it. I'm using a lot of this stuff in my classes, too, in different ways. And I think the biggest thing that I'm getting from this, too, is the operation of the mind and the brain and in conversation and how to help people have greater awareness of the language that they're using, of course, the story. This week, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to about what's your money story. So I'm actually asking
yeah.
them that question. And everybody had a response. It's like they were in touch with their money stories.
Huh, that's interesting.
And I found that interesting, too. It's like, wow, you really, yeah, it goes way back. I could tell you exactly when I got this money story.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so for me, it's been really beneficial. And we got to make plans in January, February to have you come back to for another class. So,
you know, I was just thinking about that, and going to mention to everybody. I'm just touching on some aspects of how the brain works as we're getting into these steps that we're going to talk about today. And I was going to mention that you and I are going to do the neuroscience and quantum physics of successful coaching this same time, January 17th, and we're going to talk also about contribution from psychoanalysis, Buddhism, social psychology, and then kind of integrate that to really look at how we can apply and use that to inform our coaching. So I think that's going to be an exciting, and I know, you know, Carl and I have already done that together, and he's, if he's brave enough to do that a second round, I think it'll be fun for us to do together and for this group.
Hey, the journey continues, and it's all good. So anyway, I'll shut up. Let someone else
Great. Talk. Thanks. Thanks for your response. That's very interesting. Other responses? Other thoughts? Reflections?
Hi, this is Tony. I have a couple of questions.
Welcome.
I wasn't able to. Hi there. I wasn't able to attend last week, so I listened to the recording. And I actually have to admit that I wondered whether the recording was for this group's call or whether it was from another session.
Did I sound too robotic?
No, it was actually really more that I didn't hear Carl's voice once, and I guess the dialogue was a little different than what I would have anticipated.
I see. Well, you know, I put it on lecture mode so you guys don't have to mute and that sort of thing, and then we have discussion at the beginning and the end. Would you find it more user-friendly if we had a break in the middle and had clarification or questions, or do you have suggestions about that? And I feel like there's so much I want to impart to you guys, and then we only have an hour to do it, so I'm wanting to squeeze as much as possible in, but that may not be the most effective way. You have suggestions?
Dave, this is Madeline. I think you're doing a great job. I think you should just keep it straight, keep going, fill up the hour, and the information is valuable. It's a lot there for everyone to dissect. And I think it's presented real well. I don't think we need a break.
Okay.
Excuse me, Dave?
There was another comment as Madeline was speaking that I wanted to hear, too.
Hi, yeah, this is Tony again. I think probably the one thing that would be helpful for me is that I'd really love clarification and kind of instructions, perhaps just at the very end in terms of what it is that which exercises we're expected to do in preparation for the next class. I've been a little unclear as to whether we're supposed to do the class and then do the exercises, or whether we're supposed to do the exercises first and then the class.
Okay. I thought I was clear, but I obviously wasn't in the emails in the first seminar. The outline that you have has the corresponding workbook pages or the workbook section. And I've recommended, if you are able to do the exercises prior to the seminar, that I think you'll benefit more that way.
Okay, great. And I'm sorry, I wasn't as clear as I thought I was. I get hundreds of emails a day, and so sometimes I don't read them as thoroughly as I possibly could, too. So that could have just been my fault.
Okay. Well, that's a great question and something very important. Probably needs to be in the download, which I thought it was, but I'll check on that, too, because I think that's really important. Thanks for mentioning that.
Well, it does actually say, you know, kind of which seminar it is and the workbook steps. Like I said, I was just unclear as to whether those things get done before the class or whether they're discussed in the class and then you do them after. So.
And you're obviously very popular to have several hundred emails a day. I get about
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. Other thoughts or feedback or even questions or clarification about the material from last time or from the workbook for this time? Anything you should be helpful to talk about?
Excuse me, this is Irma.
Hey, welcome.
Thanks, Dave. I listened to both sessions today, and the second session, which was recorded last week, was of another group. It sounds like some of the people were from the UK. So it was a different session. It wasn't the session.
Okay, then I need to check. Carol, we need to check and see that the right one was uploaded. Obviously, it was a different one that was uploaded. Carol, are you here? I will check with Carol tomorrow, or I'll email her after the class and be sure that it sounds like the wrong one was posted. So,
David,
let me see. I'm sorry?
David's Carol.
Hey, yeah. Did we get the wrong one posted for last time?
It has been brought to my attention that we do, and I have sent Bill an email asking him to check on that. So.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's do it. And I'll follow on all too. And I'm sorry we had a technical glitch there that the right one didn't get posted. So yeah, that was a good earlier observation that it sounded different because it was different. I'll check and see what happened, and we'll get the right one posted tomorrow. Yeah, thanks for bringing that to my attention.
Well, sure.
Anything else before we start? Any other things to talk about, or clarifications, or questions, or observations? Okay, well, that will give us some more time at the end of the seminar then, and we'll save some time for discussion at the end. We're talking today about writing new software. We've discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first three steps of change, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. In this seminar, we'll discuss the next two steps. Step four, decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Now, no fair if you've read my blog, because it came out this week a little earlier than I expected and had this study in it. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talking about sports, talking about business. They would pick one and do that consistently all day. Additionally, twice a week, he had them stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something twice a week that they had never eaten before and read something twice a week that they had never read before. What's your best guess as to the biggest change in this group? The remarkable finding to me was that after 4 months, the subjects had lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. Most continued to lose weight. Now, this wasn't a diet. It had nothing to do with diet, but a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale, requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. They become aware of every behavior. In this instance, every bite of food. So they came to recognize that everything they did was a choice. Remember we talked earlier about your writing, your story, whatever you think and feel and experience is what you create each moment. They began to recognize every bite is a choice, and they would contemplate, is this choice in my best interest? So once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide to make the most informed and strategic choices possible. And that's exactly what we do as coaches. And remember, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit's not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. That also is a coachable moment if I hear a client say that. Every action is a choice. Every thought and feeling is a choice. Let's talk a little bit more about expanding this notion of choice. Last seminar, we discussed the equation belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. For this step, decide what to change, we're going to add an equation. Now, it's not my original, but I like elegant simplicity, and I can't do any better than this one, so we're going to use it. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. And here's the equation. It's in your outline. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's the result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. Remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, and now your business is slumping a bit. You've spent more than you earned, so now you have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text, and this is how the latter sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do that. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. And a footnote here. Whatever you're doing that you can't control or don't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, or to a process, such as debt, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. Let's apply that now and talk about obstacles and desires. So here's another notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that just slightly differently. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, and I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, rather than strategizing to overcome, avoid, or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's your story to write. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but makes it safe to want if you're afraid. An example. I saw a cartoon of a dog. The dog was straining at its leash in the first frame, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame showed the cat, who was not too shabby, actually looked pretty mean, was at least as big as the dog. All of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly grabbed the leash, ran back, and tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. Now, here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. When we view a scene in a film that we don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, no, I don't want to look. But then the desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to exercise, I can't put away any savings, reflect on the underlying desire. Here's the principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. The primary obstacles that people give for not participating, for example, in retirement plans include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination because of other pressing financial demands. The way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. Here's an example of this effort. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plan, the employee has to opt out to not participate, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for the future. So when it's automatic, it's 100% initially, by definition, when it begins. Then it levels out to 86 to 94% of people participate. Only a few opt out. Now, in companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to choose to opt in, 20% participate, over a fourfold difference just based on the frame. Here are some mechanisms that research has shown work best for a retirement plan. I'm using this as an example for other possibilities here. Automatic enrollment, in other words, a good decision that you make once. Automatic annual increases in contribution rates. Automatic rebalancing of portfolios, and the huge non-secret here, you can set up your own automatic contribution. You set up an automatic withdrawal from your saving, your checking account once a month to put in your retirement account. Let's talk about change in the brain. This is crucial, I think, to understand when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how we can use this information to facilitate success in ourselves and in our clients. One, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. And this is important. We did not learn this in school. Facts and beliefs are an anatomical reality in the brain. They can't simply be removed or easily overwritten by another fact. They do, however, atrophy with disuse. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. As we mentor and co-create change, we have to start with where the client is, not where we are. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge, certainly not of their beliefs. And four, when change occurs in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So let's talk about specifically now how the brain opposes change. This is going to affect what we do as coaches. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider how our brains work. Each of these precepts will help you craft your new money story, and of course your clients, and facilitate change. The mechanisms are somewhat complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Activities that we've repeated, that have become habits, are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural nets, the highways and villages in your brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. This means that you don't have to think about how you drive the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, you can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is so energy efficient because the brain has freed up your focus to do other things. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, though, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy and use a lot more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default mode. The brain naturally resists change. It hardwires behavior to save energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. So, as a footnote here, don't take it personally when your client is resistive. They're just as frustrated as you are. They're showing you exactly what it's like to be them. Specifically, they're showing you exactly how their brains are wired. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know it yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs can turn genes on or turn them off. This is a quote from one of my favorite authors, Ray Kurzweil. This is from The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. The number two way that the brain opposes change. Change creates dissonance. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. Now, this is not a function. This is an actual part of the brain. It's really close to the emotional center. And you know you can never ignore your next door neighbors. The brain has this innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, the difference between expectation and perceived actuality. It registers as a sense that something's just not quite right. Since a portion of your medial frontal cortex has this job description to recognize and correct errors, consider an application here. Consider the emotional expense of debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that you have to pay more for it. Then, the emotional expense of your mind and the dissonance of your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. The error detection mechanism, you know, says you cannot afford this. Then, you have to pay the interest, triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. There's a blog about how debt and lies are similar because the error detection mechanism also picks up your lies. It's in my blog archives. Now, the good news here, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. So this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response to change itself. And this can be read by a client as when they're trying something new, the error detection mechanism says, whoa, this is not right. So they're saying, well, you know, my instinct, I feel uncomfortable with that. My instinct is telling me that I better not do this. That's a misread. That's a misread of the error detection mechanism as if it were an instinct. So 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Usual guesses may be 3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. This is an example. A company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row with projected earnings growth this quarter of 24 cents per share. They announce, and that's the analyst, that's the whisper number and the projection by the analyst both. They announce earnings of, instead of 24 cents, 23 cents. In the next 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. Now, what changed in those 5 minutes? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet or the mindset of the investors? Just because the analyst screwed up by a penny. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. You can see how, I agree by the way, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes. Listing 2 things and a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, payoff. Seinfeld is a genius at this. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict, envision the right things. Number 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Your COO, chief operating officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer, neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short term, but they draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. Remember we talked about from quantum physics, you get what you focus on, not what you want. The focus here. And secondly, the focus is the same. Recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And I can't tell you what a departure from over 2 decades as a card-carrying psychoanalyst and senior training analyst that is, because psychoanalysis is a theory of motivation, and it's about helping people understand their unconscious motivation. So here I am, a coach, saying you don't have to be motivated. Someone may not generate motivation until they set a goal, because an action can generate its own motivation. Many of the professional athletes off-season and professional actors get up in the morning and go to the gym, but they aren't motivated to do that. They just do it. Sometimes during the course of the workout, maybe late into it, they get motivated some, but mostly they just do the workout because they know it's the thing to do in order to do what's next. Motivation is not essential, but having a plan and sticking to it are. You don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. Just set up an automatic payment or participation plan. You just need a plan and stick to it. You only need to make a good choice one time. The quality of many future years will be affected. And 6, in terms of how the brain opposes change. Emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals of dopamine and adrenaline are released, and they prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotion gets activated. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. So thinking positive thoughts is like talking to your computer software and asking it to change. In fact, one of the philosophers, one of the named philosophers of the 21st century put it this way, put it quite simply, everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. When the possibility, when there's a possibility of reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipating that reward, a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or blackjack table. Here's what we know now. We've talked about this in discussion and touched on it. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine, as people thought for decades, but it's the anticipation of reward. When gamblers were studied, their increased brain firing and dopamine spike occurred before they ever touched the slot machine. Secondly, the less predictable a reward is, now think about the applications here, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. If a laboratory mouse is given regular predictable rewards for pushing a lever, the behavior stops quickly when the food pellet rewards stop. Very, very quick exhaustion of that behavior. However, if the food pellets are infrequent and unpredictable, intermittent reward, the mouse will keep punching the lever almost indefinitely. This behavior is not confined to laboratory mice. Watch the bank of slot machines in Vegas, and you'll see the same scenario, complete with lever pulling and reward pellets, or pushing a button and seeing pellets drop down occasionally. And here's the, you know, when you get two clusters of cherries, you get excited, and the anticipation of the third will keep you going. So they pattern those to have those occur frequently. When you get almost there and you get all excited, darn, you're good for another, you know, 10 runs at it. So the moral, people easily fall into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure despite the obviously illogical downside. And seven, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. Think about how you get up for a presentation and get just right on point and get an edge. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of edge short term enhance learning. The time window, though, on this phenomenon is up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for most of the executives and professionals I've worked with is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. In fact, I want to send you guys, I'll make a note while I'm saying this, I want to send you a module that is totally about regulating, mastering states of mind. And I'll send it to you as an attachment because it will let you see a bit more about this than we have time to talk about. Number eight, in terms of how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor isn't their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. Another place I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he started 32 years ago to his two children to own and manage. They've been doing things the same way for 32 years. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes both roles and relationships, and the company is under new management. Now, these last two principles, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. Nine, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bus. Exactly what we do in coaching. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. Creativity, memory. And these studies have been replicated very recently in non-invasive ways in two human populations, London taxicab drivers and medical students at the University of Hamburg. Another finding, and this is the antithesis of this, stress, chronic stress, impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells goes the other direction, decreases. And this is why with chronic stress, people have trouble remembering and are not as creative. 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning and developing cortical real estate. In illustration, some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that absolutely reversed everything. Down was up was down, consistently, 24 hours a day. So they had to think through every move they made, reversing everything to think every movement. Then about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustment. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had developed new neural pathways. Their brains had rewired so things looked normal to them. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on for their brains to rewire. That, I think, emphasizes the necessity of consistency. And more recently, there have been some studies that have showed that more complex patterns, like behavioral patterns, attachment patterns, that we have hardwired and change, they're not as persnicative about a one-time slip, because when they're more complex, two things, they take longer to change, sometimes even a few months, so that deal about 21 days or 25 days or 30 days may not apply, but it's also like you make one slip, you readjust and you're not back at square one. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Now let's talk about step 5, map changes. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I don't know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman that I will pay you what you ask." Well, considering the options, the man agreed to the terms and handed him the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single piece of paper, gave it one look, a mere glance, and then handed the piece of paper back to the man and wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. I'm going to save you guys some big money here. There were two sentences on the page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." Now, there are 6 crucial elements to map change. We'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the 6, an outline to master your money story. 1, regulate states of mind. And again, I'm going to send you the module for much more detail, but I'll just highlight a couple of things here. Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics, in part by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. And remember here, market bubbles are simply collective states of mind where people get on collective tilt. He did a series of trading experiments with economic graduate students, no novices here. They were informed that the fair value of a security, a stock, was $3. So these traders knew the actual worth of the security. It's a significant advantage over the normal Wall Street situation because it's not a market, it's an auction. And the stock is worth whatever somebody's going to bid for it. So what happened in price bidding? They still ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark. In this first round, they ran it up, in most instances, to almost $6. When other traders in the experiment stopped paying a premium, the laboratory market crashed. Now, in a second experiment with the same group, they formed another smaller bubble. It wasn't until the third time around that they wised up to stay with the security's actual value, even though they had known it from the start. When Dr. Smith repeated the experiment with finance professors and other economic specialists, even more sophisticated, they formed the same kind of bubbles. They weren't as high. They were in the high $4 the first time, followed by the same crashes. And the third time, they regulated. They got smart. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and how we process information and how we respond. We each have a set of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, just to name a few. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind and know which state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing. Two different states of mind, two different functions not to mix. Brainstorming versus completing a project, two states of mind to be kept distinct again. When someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward their right brain response, their feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual logical brain and hold it hostage. And the same thing can happen when the left brain dominates in worry or in a negative thought loop and rumination. It can go the same loop and overwhelm any balance and applying any emotion. So what do? Your brain is working against you. When you're in any state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings and restore a cool state, a balance of left and right brain. And poker players, as I mentioned, call it tilt. When you lose big or win big at poker, you're emotional and inclined to play your last hand or your leftover emotion. It affects several hands into the future. With any kind of tilt, break the state of mind and have some options ready. And here are just some examples. Step away from the table, whether it's poker or conference or dinner table, or take a walk, or just go wash your hands and face with cold water. You have an unlimited, this is not the NBA, you have an unlimited number of timeouts. Or just breathe deeply. Even sleep on it, because that moves you through several states to consider it in a very balanced state the next day. Let me think about that and get back to you is a decision. Then you can respond when your state of mind is balanced. I want to refer you one more time to a blog archive called Sleep On It, The Neuroeconomics of Striking When the Iron is Cold. You'll just see the title Sleep On It, and there's more elaboration there. The number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. And this is what I want to talk about, I've alluded to before. This is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. And I'm going to just mention it briefly because I mentioned that Carl and I are going to be doing another seminar series in, January 17th, this same time, on quantum physics, the neuroscience and quantum physics of successful coaching. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. All the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available, but we choose the channel, the frequency we want out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel. Change your thoughts. The bad news, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. So we get what we focus on, not what we want. According to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno effect, Z-E-N-O, says the mental act of attention, focusing in other words, activates and holds in place brain circuitry. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links become stable changes in the brain's structure. In other words, the brain rewires. Quantum physics offers us still another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there is a collective field. It's what happens with you and your client, or you and a group of people. And you can tap into it and resonate with this field, the quantum field of possibility. Einstein called this the unified field theory. Basically, the human mind and body are bundles of energy, but interact with the larger energy field. This is how we can read people, how we can focus our choices and determine the flow of our future. So what do you do to tap into this collective field? Well, we project energy frequencies, and like a magnet, attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, that'll be what we create. If we focus on positive and on solutions, that'll be what we create. This concept offers an explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus, which is what we do in coaching, is more effective than a problem focus. These brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. So the paradox, again, is that we don't attract what we want, but we attract what we focus on. Everybody wants more money, so wanting is not the key to having it. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity aligns your energy to pursue prosperity. And your unconscious doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus. It's like the old style camera. A print or negative is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. And the power of focus is that whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. The focus is on debt. I want to lose weight. The focus is on overweight. Here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners busy. I want to be really careful and not spill anything on this new outfit. Number three, visualize changes. There's a whole, I've included a chapter from Outsmart Your Brain in the addendum to your workbook on the art and science, the new art and old science of visualization, and there's some aspect of affirmations there too, which is the story that supports the visualization. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. And the third group, they practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. Third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. Now, there have been some studies subsequently where they've refined the method and the visualization actually trumps the actual practice because you don't ever have any misses in your visualization. You do it consistently, nothing but net. So create an image of your goal and live into it. On brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as when you actually shoot or actually do a physical activity. Visualization simply crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience, when it's done consistently, changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. You create a future memory. Four, insight changes the brain. We touched on this already. At the moment of insight, and in coaching we call it an aha experience usually, a complex new set of neural connections is created. Three parts of the brain light up on fMRI scan during this moment of insight, this aha. It vaults someone to a different state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and integrative. It releases certain chemicals in the brain that create the state change, as well as lighting up. When someone is given information, contrast this now, when somebody is given a fact, a directive, an order, or information, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Now, as important as this insight-induced change is, the sustained attention is what hardwires it to the brain circuit. Five, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes, and produce results. This may be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kind of degrees, and I've been in one of those, I know what I'm talking about, can plan and figure something out, but struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of the first year of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And number six, transform identity. We're going to talk about this as the P of roadmap. It's really important, I think. A new experience or idea must be focused on consistently and frequently. Then brain circuitry is stabilized. The mindset of identity incorporates this new experience and integrates it as part of an evolving self, as a component of one's identity. This is what we help clients do as coaches. We help them change the model of how and who they see themselves to be to incorporate this new behavior and experience. Otherwise, it's not integrated and prone to be dismissed as a not me experience or attributed to luck or circumstance. So that's exactly what we're going to talk about in Step 7, Program New Identity, next seminar. So in summary here, this is an application of Steps 4 and 5, deciding and mapping change. Let's apply it to your debt story. And I'd recommend doing the three exercises under your debt story in Step 5, if you haven't already, beginning page 5.10. Debt cycle stealth. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lended rather than how much you can pay back. Spending money generates the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. Fulfilling a wish creates the desire. Marketers know this really well. When desires define identity, the quest becomes unrelenting. Many people who fall heavily into debt do not necessarily have psychological problems, but because spending takes on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. They then try to afford what they buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. It's also hard to say because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. It activates the same pleasure in the center in the brain that dopamine does. Spending money is addictive. It changes a state of mind. It's difficult to substitute a theory, future need, long-term saving, retirement, for the immediate. The most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making, this is from a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Kahneman. The most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we choose a small amount of something right now rather than a larger amount in the future. So here are some possibilities to counter these tendencies that I've just mentioned. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at University College of London has shown that imagining a future purchase has the same effect in the brain as getting it. Remember, with visualization, it activates in the same way. Saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision, like a vacation, like college tuition. It's easier and more specific to create a distinct vision for each goal, like the vacation, the tuition, a new house. Here's another. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real figures. Correctly represent the magic of compound interest. This is the compound interest of the eighth wonder of the world. Figure out, for example, the money you're planning to spend. Figure out, before you spend it at least, what that would be worth compounded at average market value in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. So the $100 you spend now, how much would you have in retirement if you chose not to? That makes it real and tangible. Here are just a couple of examples. Investing $1.50 a day, beginning at age 20, based on the stock market average growth since 1926, by age 65 would be worth $1. Wait till age 21 instead of 20, the difference is $109,000. Another example. Investing $2,000 a year in an IRA, a retirement account, beginning at age 18, then stopping all investment by age 30. By age 65, would be worth $1 million. Another that I've already mentioned, automatically deduct retirement savings each month. The commitment device is a decision you only have to make once. And here's what credit cards do. They segment the pleasure of spending, the stimulation of the pleasure center, from the pain of future payment, activates a pain center in the brain, a totally different part of the brain. So what credit cards do is segment the pain from the purchase. It's later. You know, tomorrow's another day. Then our optimism bias makes rainy days and repayment an abstraction. So our minds kick in here, too. Rationalization heightens in proportion to the elastic boundaries, even. pay off in 3 months stretches to 6 or 12. Increasing abstraction of money emotionally distances from the obligation of debt. A faceless credit card company then becomes a vague authority. And here's a recent economic study that showed that credit card holders are consciously aware of only $4 of every $10 they owe. I mean, I'm not talking about close here. This study didn't say it's only aware, consciously aware of $4 of every $10. It's not that they just slightly missed it a little bit. They were totally unaware of $6. This underestimation is a form of denial. Debt has been called a secret sin because of the shame attached. Probably the most, here's just in summary. I want to quote a real expert here. Here's what an expert had to say. This is Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. So I'm talking serious business here. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle, how they don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why they call it the executive game. So we render money an abstraction and deceive ourselves. I can do it on my credit card, and it won't be an immediate expense. As Richard Medley said, free money makes you stupid. And remember this from everything you've heard. Right now, saving and the future are both abstractions. There will be a time when they will both be very real. Okay, well, let's talk about your thoughts, questions, reflections.
This is Lynn.
Yeah, please. Hey.
And I have a question. When you were back talking about stress, I wanted to ask you about that. That we have to regulate stress because stress causes. I'm looking at my notes here. I'm trying to find it where stress causes. Do you remember exactly what you said?
Well, one of the things is that stress has the number of cells in the hippocampus decrease, so it will affect our chronic stress, will affect our memory and our creativity because of
okay.
the actual physical decrease of the number of cells in the hippocampus.
Okay. When you think of stress, when I think of stress and the stress I'm experiencing in my life, how powerful is my mindset over that versus, I mean, to me, stress is a perception.
Absolutely.
And even so am I fooling myself by having a positive attitude and looking at things that I'm not experiencing stress, or am I still experiencing it?
Well, I think you get what you focus on, and if you're focusing on the positive things, a lot of problems can't be. This is from Jung, and I'm kind of botching the quote, but he said, you know, a lot of problems can't be solved. You just have to outlive them. So
right.
you're focusing on the things that you can do. And that's one of the things that we do as coaches, if you think about it, is we help a client look at the things they can determine, their circle of influence, from all the things they can't determine, their circle of concern. And all the things they can't determine range from, you know, the ozone and global warming to exactly how their spouse responds. And you focus on what you can determine. So that creates a focus, not just a positive, because, you know, that may be a little deceptive, but on what you can be effective in doing. And that creates the sense of effectiveness and of mastery. And effectiveness is the most basic desire that we have as human beings. I've seen films from direct infant observation studies as early as 3 months of life, and they have a motivation that can be measured then of effectiveness, to be a cause of effectance pleasure. They want to experience mastery. That's what we do throughout life. That's what we do in each coaching session when we ask a client, what would you like us to get done today? We want to create a success map that has an ending, because the second question is some form of, where would you like us to get to in terms of what you want to take away? So we're creating a sense of effectiveness for that mini episode in the bigger story of coaching. And we're co-creating a success map that the client and you are looking at and achieving. So that's the focus that you're creating. So I think you're doing exactly what needs to be done. And, you know, there are a lot of things. You know, the ozone layer, wanting my wife to respond exactly how I want her to respond, that ain't going to happen. So I might as well get busy with what I can do something about.
Well, and in Carl's, one of Carl's many things I've done, or maybe it was your class, I don't know, I'm involved in so many things, there's the stress test. And they say you take the stress test, and if you're over 300, you've got too much stress. And my question is, if you have a lot of stressors but you handle them well by your attitude and by being proactive, and when you're coaching and people, because you hear people say, oh, I'm under so much stress. And I guess my question is changing that mindset, that is diffusing the stress. Is that correct?
My simple answer is yes, it's about changing the mindset. Because what you're doing with a different mindset and the principle of whatever you experience, you either accept or you create, you're looking at the mindset that stress is kind of a vague abstraction. Yeah, you experience it physically, but if you look at everything like that, as well as every feeling, as a verb, so stress is not this quantum of energy that needs to be dissipated any more than anger is. You're creating the stress by your response. So you're responding stressfully, just as you're responding angrily. Now, if you look at it in that way, it makes your response a choice. And then if you choose, you can have the best and most informed choice possible. Every bite is a choice. Every response of feeling, of action, proactive or reactive, is a choice. So you can look at what works and what doesn't. That's the bottom line here, is does it work? So I think it is a mindset, but it's a mindset of looking at you're actively writing your story every moment, whatever you think, feel, experience. Do you like what you're creating? If you don't, then examine that storyline and see what needs to be changed. Does that make sense in terms of your question?
Yes, very much so. Yes.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. That's a great question also. We have about another minute, another comment or question?
It's probably too big a question for a minute, but I'm curious to know what helps get clients from that concept of abstraction for saving for the future and retirement to actually really being able to absorb that as a sense of reality.
Would you ask that question again? Would you just say that again about your question is what specifically?
You were saying that saving money and saving for retirement are abstractions that eventually become real.
Yes.
So my assumption is that one of the reasons why people don't do it at the time when they should get started is because it's an abstraction. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for how to make it real for them.
Well, that's why I gave that example of saving $1.50 a day or putting in $2,000 for this finite period of time. There are two principles there. One is the regularity just of, you know, coffee money, that it can make a difference cumulatively. You know, $1 million. You do one cup of coffee less, or you do, you know, or you make a concerted effort for a period of time early on, and then you get the miracle of compound interest. You know, the eighth wonder of the world is not that new mall in Dubai that's twice as big as one in Minnesota. It's compound interest. You know, give somebody an assignment. And let me give you guys an assignment. You probably remember this from being a kid. I'll work for you if you'll just pay me a penny a day and double it. And I'll work for you for a month, 31 days. You know, have any of you done that? Do you recall offhand how much that would be? Over $10 million.
Wow.
Oh, I was going to ask Carl if he would do that for, you know, a series of seminars. So, I think it's a great idea to make it real, to make it tangible and concrete, because money is that. You know, if we look at money as the very simple entity that it is, that it's a simple unit of exchange, and we start with that or come back to that, with appreciating the simplicity of something, then we can see all the complexity that we attach. And that takes a lot of work sometimes, and that's our work as coaches. Well, I know we're out of time. Thank you all very much. Very interesting comments, questions, and thank you all for your energy and input. I appreciate it. Look forward to picking up with you next time.
Good job,
bye,
Dave.
Now.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Absolutely. See you
bye.
Guys.
Bye. Bye, community.